Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It is the Anfield app. Neil Atkinson with Dan Morgan, with Gareth Robertson, with Ian Ryan. To do a number of things. Coming up, we've got Clive Tildesley, Henri Clements. We also have Martina Cox talking about her book with John Gibbons as well. We're going to, in general, be talking about the injuries. We're going to start off and we're going to talk about the injuries in the wider football sense, everything that's going on. Then we're going to move ourselves forward to Liverpool's injury-specific crisis. And then we will close this off having a conversation about the January transfer window. And in between there, you will have Clive and Martina. Let's start off, though, with the reality of all of this. Dan Morgan from Liverpool.com. There is this little thing where, in the wider football sense, the footballers are dropping like flies, whether it's through coronavirus or through injuries. It is now noticeable that the coronavirus numbers of tests positive are increasing. And there is something else to point out as well, which is practically every game seems to be resulting in some degree of what always looks like a bit of a muscle injury for one player or another, whoever they play for.
Yeah, I think it's... I just wonder sort of within clubs now how much of the, you know, the strict sort of guidelines that they have for the players are changing. Like how much they're changing their own goalposts with this. How much they're putting a player on the pitch at maybe 70-80% in the red, for example, as we've sort of come to define it, and how much of that is ultimately necessary. I mean, I thought it was interesting that Gareth Southgate basically now bangs the drum for the Premier League to rethink five subs when, you know, he's already took a full squad of England players away and used the majority of what he could in one game, which is fair enough to him. You know, I don't think it's as simple as saying, you know, let's stop these players coming on international duty or whatever. That argument has never been a valid one, because people often forget that these players love actually going to their home countries and love playing for the countries.
And also the national, in the same way we talked about when Project Restart happened, the football clubs needed the money. The national associations need the television money, not least because they're the ones who in this country, but Slovenia as an example, who's bailing out Slovenia for the money that they owe when they couldn't play, etc., etc.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, nothing on him or on international football or managers in general. But yeah, really, really sort of difficult for Liverpool. And I think Liverpool are sort of I'd put it through sheer bad luck in terms of injuries in a sense, but also through just being mainly, you know, the team with the crown on their head, aren't they? And the team everyone wants to come at and the team everyone wants to beat. And to see Liverpool drop, I think, obviously carries more weight than it does Sheffield United, for example. But the reverberations of such carry the same for each club, and the massive for each club. And I think it's going to get to a point where it doesn't matter if you can put five subs on the pitch, because ultimately you're then scratching in the 18s for players, and it's dire, to be honest. It's desperate.
Gareth, you can have bad luck, and you know Liverpool in places have had bad luck. You can have bad luck, but then that bad luck has knock-on effects. So one of the reasons why, and it's not to connect all these things because we're not sports scientists, we don't proclaim to be, but one of the reasons why, for instance, Joe Gomez has to play every game is because Virgil van Dijk gets the injury. Virgil van Dijk gets the injury, it's bad luck, it's the challenge from the goalkeeper, that's what does for him, but that's the knock-on effect. One of the reasons why Trent Alexander-Arnold, Liverpool feel he has to play every game, is because they've got no consistent person to play right-hand side at centre-half, so you don't want to risk the whole right-hand side by, for instance, resting Trent. So it's bad luck, and then it's exhaustion. But it isn't just Liverpool. So many of these teams have just had no pre-season worth a carrot. And it is, we're not, there's every chance we're having this conversation again in 6 weeks, and we're talking about teams where 50% of the squad is out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just going to be a strange season, isn't it? It's going to be sort of, you know, we're used to sort of seeing thoroughbreds going through a sort of a long distance run, and this is suddenly asking those very same thoroughbreds to, you know, be doing a triathlon, and they haven't trained for it. And so, you know, all of a sudden the goalposts have moved, and we're just going to keep on seeing this. It's just going to be a real slog. I don't think we're going to see huge numbers like we have done the last few seasons to win the league. I think that number will significantly come down. And if there's a little sort of ray of hope, but you know, which is bizarre to say, but like, you know, the Sky did quite a good piece over the weekend about all the injuries and about how it's affected everyone. And they did the graph, and, you know, not surprisingly, Liverpool are right there at the top, but Man City are one ahead. They've suffered 16 yeah. injuries this season to Liverpool's 15. And, you know, when you think that's one of our, you know, true competitors for the title, I think, then, you know, you can start to look at it and say, okay, well, things aren't that bad, because there we are right at the top. Here we are at the top of the league and all that. And equally with the Champions League as well, you know, we've done so well to get all those points on the board. You know, it would take a huge slip now not to qualify for the next bit of the Champions League. So there's sort of opportunities there for us to manage this. And I think, you know, we've talked all the way through, you know, supporting this side, supporting Jurgen Klopp's teams, about the mentality. I mean, this is the truest test of it yet. But I think what you've seen so far still gives you hope. I think, you know, you look at players that have just come in from the complete cold and performed. Okay, Shaqiri's not going to play centre-half. But
why not?
But I just
let's
think,
live a little.
But, you know, like, seeing players like him come in and perform to the level they have done tells you that behind the scenes things are as good as they can be in the circumstances. Is that the same at Man City? Do Man City feel a little bit more sorry for themselves? I'd suggest maybe they do. So I think Liverpool have got a mental strength advantage, but at the same time, I just think, you know, there's two aspects to this. You know, the emotional side of you as a football fan thinks, fuck's sake, when you see the injury list and, you know, Mo getting corona and all the rest of it. But then I think when you sort of take a little bit of a step back and try and use the more computer side of your brain, you think, well, we've got a good squad these days, though. We've got some good players at the club. We've got a good manager, a good assistant manager, a good team, good mentality. And look, you know, it's no coincidence that players keep coming in like Nat Phillips and like Reece Williams and doing well. That's because they're coached really well. That's because the club, the culture is absolutely spot on. I think at other clubs, and even at Liverpool in the past, you know, you would almost use the situation to go, oh, fuck that, then that's the season done. Liverpool won't do that.
The idea of what Liverpool do and have done in training, I think hits in here, Ian, in terms of what Gareth's saying. There is still that frustration that the manager didn't get the pre-season he would have wanted. It could be worse. Let's be absolutely frank about this, and for once quite magnanimous. Both the Manchester clubs had an absolute wreck of a pre-season, and if I genuinely believe that if that had been us, you would have heard a lot more from our manager about it, given the stock and story he puts in the way he coaches these players. But as Gareth says there, all these players have been now working with one another with this manager for some time. In a lot of cases, they've got a lot of experience of what the demands are and of what you need to do to be a Liverpool player in these circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think on the wider point, I remember reading an article that alluded to the fact that clubs are used to managing players in a certain way. So in a typical season, you've got the summer, then you've got your training camps, and then you've got your pre-season, then you've got your games. There's all these transition points that clubs are used to managing, and at each turn, there's probably higher risk of maybe muscle injuries. All that's off the table now. It's a totally different landscape, and clubs are having to manage it in a different way. There's challenges there. Obviously, some of the best medical staff work for these clubs, so I'm sure they can manage some of these challenges, but it is a challenge nonetheless. And I think it is extremely difficult now for clubs to work their way through a season. And sometimes you don't actually know just how bad it's going to be until you're in it. Neil, you were doing shows every week, every month, a lot of games, you know. I'm on my walk like that. Yeah, a lot of games. You're fine. When you're in it, fuck me, there's a lot of games. Where are these internationals coming from? There's 3 weeks. You know, you're thinking, no one told me about them, and no one wants to give anything up. No one wants to let anything go. So you said before, the FAs, the hemorrhaging money, but we're not letting those friendlies go. There's international tournaments on the horizon. We've got to have these qualifiers. Okay, what can we do domestically? Could we give the League Cup up? No, because the little clubs need the League Cup. Could we compensate them? No, we're going to play the League Cup. Okay, we'll play the League Cup. But something had to give and nothing has. So now we're flogging these lads. And listen, I'm someone who likes to see lots of football, but there is a tipping point, and we're flogging these lads now to the point where the product is becoming worse, and you're going to see less and less of the better players. You're going to see scratch sides at times, and it is the same for everyone, but it's not great. It's not a great place to be, and you're thinking, could they have done something? Could some clever people have got around the table and thought this through a little bit better?
On the idea of the product, I think you see it Liverpool versus City, Dan, looking back on that game now with the benefit of a fair bit of time, the last 20 minutes especially genuinely feels like extra time in a summer tournament game. It's almost walking football from both sides. It felt like both sides, there's a little bit of a tacit something of, we're all right here, aren't we? Maybe if an opportunity comes up, we'll get after it. That is something I think we may well have to be prepared for. Our next game's against Leicester. It's a massive match. Both sides will be determined to win. But there's a part of me that wonders if the game feels determined one way or another on about 20, with 20 to go, if both sides might just think, you know what, we just get out here because both have got European commitments in the week.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a sort of mindset within Liverpool now in terms of how many of the next 12 games they can win in the first 30 minutes, for example. Like how much you can just, as Liverpool, kill hearts and therefore kill legs and kill minds. And I think that to do that in an opening 45, for example, is going to make life a lot easier because, as you've rightly alluded to, I think a lot of teams will take the fate that's given to them if the game's requiring a lot more in a second 45 than it is in the first to get back into it against a side with a name like Liverpool, then yeah, that's an example of where this could go with the City. The City one's prime, but I think the other thing to counter in all of this is, again, you know, there's a lack of fans. And we're talking about a product already being watered down. This becomes to the point where the gravitas of the whole enterprise gets questioned to a degree for me, because you cannot ask people to invest emotionally as much as they do and then give them what is essentially what looks like a simulation at the end of the week that none of us feel in any way, shape or form attached to in the way that we once did.
It means it's different though, doesn't it? It means it's a different ball game. So like, you know, people are sort of saying all the time, like, which of these other teams who are about could genuinely challenge? And I've got to say, I keep thinking, maybe Tottenham could, because Mourinho's a proper arse, doesn't give a shit anyway. And when there's no fans in the ground, you can arse your way to a result all you want and no one's going to complain about it.
At home as well.
Yeah, at home as well, that's what I mean. I just, the other thing that I thought what you said before, Dan, was really interesting, sort of, and just to take that on, I wonder among all this about the sort of darker arts in terms of what we don't know about. So, you know, you look at that massive injury list Liverpool have got, but for instance, Robertson plays the game that counts and then in his interview straight after goes, felt me hamstring there, you know. And I just wonder, and I'm just putting it out there, but, you know, is someone at Liverpool, is Robertson himself going, I've played the one that mattered and now I'm not playing them with the ones who I want to get back and be all right for Liverpool? As the same happened with Henderson.
Sterling as well, let's be honest. Cause it's
because we used to say it all the time about Ferguson, didn't we? You know, like, Giggs never played for Wales and all that, and we all used to, like, sort of half laugh at it, the reasons why he wouldn't play. But are Liverpool maybe manipulating that now? I hope so.
Robert, because if they're not, they should be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean? Yeah.
Okay, we will go over now to Clive Tilsley, me speaking to Clive Tilsley about the late, great Ray Clements. Neil Atkinson joined by Clive Tilsley to talk about Liverpool's legendary goalkeeper, but also Clive's lifelong friend, Ray Clements, who passed away on Sunday. Clive, it's a difficult conversation. I know it's a difficult conversation almost in a sense to have with you, because we are talking here not just about a Liverpool great, but someone to whom you were very close. So to sort of take these bits in order, the first thing that we have to say on the Anfield Wrap is that this is a man who won everything there was to win with Liverpool, was the linchpin of a defence that was the driving force in making Liverpool the worldwide name it is today. There are few Liverpool icons whose passing should be mourned, but also whose lives should be celebrated as much as Ray Clements.
Absolutely. And I was fortunate enough, obviously, to see him play quite regularly. He was a great, to overused word in our game, in life, but he was definitely one of the best three goalkeepers in the world in his prime, and that prime lasted a lot longer than Liverpool thought it was going to do. So he was a great player. and but he was an even greater man, and in many ways, I think it can be almost difficult to be as celebrated and appreciated in a public way as footballers are, as performers are, and still remain sufficiently rooted, still have you know, all the perspective that goes with being able to communicate with anybody and everybody that you come across, and leave an impression on them which is unanimously good. But that was Ray. I think being at Liverpool helped. I think being on Merseyside helps, even though he's not from Merseyside. He regards it as home. V, you know, talk about the great teams I've seen. Ray and V are one of them. V's a Merseysider, and he, you know, he looks very much to the city as his home, even though he had great days with Tottenham and indeed with England too. And I guess the illnesses. It's been the best part of 20 years fighting it. You know, if anything's going to give you perspective, it's the threat of having your life taken away from you prematurely when you're enjoying it. But he was, you know, he even before all of that, he was just one of the most easy people to be around, one of the warmest people I've ever come across. You know, that big smile that lit up the room whenever he walked into it was not a facade. That was him. That was Ray. And I can't think of anybody who's got a bad word to say about him.
There's so many good words to say about him, Clive. You know, you've mentioned there the way in which he was away from the game, but within the game there was a modesty and also a work ethic that comes through all of that side that sort of that end of Shankly sort of powers through the Paisley era, that there was within that, it was a work ethic, a joy in the work as well, but a work ethic around the idea of becoming the best. Liverpool win the Champions League in 2019. They won one in 2005. They're now in it most years. There's four English clubs in it most years. I think we sort of miss what 1977 actually meant, what it actually was, what it was to the country as well as to Liverpool. And the sheer drama, the spectacle, and what then the scale of the achievement actually was. That's not to talk down what happens now. It's instead to say that those European Cups were almost like bolts from the blue. They were almost heavenly trophies, and Ray was also important in them.
Yeah, it was a fabulous team. Late 70s, early 80s. I mean, we can make another piece of content about the greatest Liverpool team. But over and above the honours that they won, as you suggest, the breakthrough and the evolution from Bill's team, which, you know, Bill's miracle was that he arrived on Merseyside when he did and got it. You know, he got what was happening, that it was pretty much the centre of the world at the time because of four guys who weren't very good at football and a lot of others who could play and sing and make people laugh and make people think. And, you know, that created an energy within the city which somehow was propelled into these red shirts that ran out in front of the Kop. And that it was that energy really which made the initial inroads into creating the era, which is, people talk about managers with a project. The Shankly project's still going on. You know, what he started is still going on. And you know, it's not a whim of fancy to say that you still see a lot of Bill in Jürgen, and you still see a lot of Bill's team in this team. But actually, Bob Paisley evolved the team and made it a passing team, made it a team that played with its head as much, if not more, than with its heart. And Ray straddled that era, you know, one of the few. I mean, you know, Kelly became a different player. And in a way, I think Ray had to become a different goalkeeper. He was physically courageous. There were definite comparisons with Ali, with Alisson Becker, in so much that he made critical saves in games in which he had little to do, which is the hallmark of a great goalkeeper with a great team. And but he made physically courageous saves. I mean, obviously, the game was a little bit different. I don't know what the average age of a Anfield Rap subscriber is, but I guess it's probably too young for too many of you to really know what Ray was like as a goalkeeper. Well, he wasn't a million miles away from Alison Becker is what I'm saying, but it was a different era. I mean, old buggers like me, you moan about the game sort of, you know, having been sanitized now. It hasn't. I mean, there are still tackles, still bad tackles. Ask Virgil, you know, there are still bad tackles. But there isn't the routine crashing challenges from behind, which you could have four or five before the referee ticked you off. And there wasn't, and there isn't now the following through on the goalkeeper that there was in the late 70s and early 80s. And Ray had to resist all of that. He had to be a physically very, very brave man indeed. And he had to have the agility and the instincts to be able to make the big saves when it mattered. He was a very vocal goalkeeper. He wasn't a goalkeeper who wanted to see action. He wanted the four guys, well, the 10 guys in front of him, to give him as little to do as possible. And he kept them on their toes and organized them. So he was a personality goalkeeper too. So that's the picture of the goalkeeper that we're talking about. He did have a genuine rival in the England squad, let alone in world football, to be the best goalkeeper in the world for much of his career. And Peter Shilton was a different kind of a goalkeeper. Peter Shilton played his club football for a less good team and therefore had more to do. But, I mean, he was a genuine rival. They were very, very good, both of them, but they were different. But Ray is... I know Peter. Peter's a good man, but Ray's a great man. Ray's personality that he showed on the football field has been shown every day of his life since until Sunday lunchtime. It just remained the same guy.
There is the image that I saw being shared, just to sort of sum up, which I just adored at the weekend, was the one where he returns with Tottenham. And Liverpool, if you haven't seen the image, do find it. But it's the copper claiming Ray Clemens. But they're not just claiming Ray Clemens during a nothing game. Liverpool need to win the title. And Liverpool are 1-0 down. And Clemens comes back and runs towards the cop. And there's two aspects to it. There's the way in which he's acclaimed. That you know, it's everybody. There is nobody who isn't doing the thing that they should do, Clive, at that moment. But it's also like Ray bristles with energy in terms of returning that acclaim. Like it's fizzing out of him almost, like this thing that's happening to him. And you know, that's my sort of, from as a supporter, as a younger supporter, having grown up watching the videos, having read the books, that's my sort of defining memory. And I can see you're nodding away there. What is that one of yours as well of him?
Yeah, there's a third part to it too. And I'm glad that the content that's been posted contains what follows all of that, which is Ray trying to get his head back together again, trying to get this out of his mind and stop Liverpool, you know, stop Liverpool, because that's his job. And it's only a few years ago that he went on the cop for the first time. He made a really good friend, and I'm sorry I don't know his name. Funny enough, through a charity golf thing, they played together, and this guy, I want to say Neil, they've got... It might be another Neil, that they've got season tickets on the cop. And Ray went there. It's only probably maybe 4 or 5 years ago he sat on the cop for the first time, which when you think about how many times he guarded that goal and how many thousands of people have stood and mainly stood or sat on that famous terrace and seen the back of him and, you know, seen the best of him. And it was a big spiritual moment for Ray to go and to watch a game from the cop. They put 5 past Arsenal. How long ago? In fact, it's less than that, isn't it? It's not long ago. And I spoke to him for quite a long time on Saturday, and that was something which came up, cropped up in the conversation. You know, I'm very, very lucky to have known him and to had his friendship for so long, but I did get to see him just before lockdown, and you know, I've got some pretty vivid sort of memories of him, and one or two people. I know Dougie Livermore got down to see him just before lockdown, and really good friend. I know that Kenny called on Saturday. He spoke to Kenny on Saturday. And likes of Ozzie Ardiles and Glenn Hoddle and Paul Miller have been in to see him in, you know, he's it's only sort of whatever, 10 days ago. So, yeah, I mean, the cop is home. The mural, sadly, never got to see it, but his granddaughter spoke brilliantly, and he's seen obviously all of the film that the family took when he was when it was unveiled. I think Stephen lives in the Manchester area. Sarah lives in the two of the three children live in the Manchester area, still kind of northwest. V's got a brother in McGull. Even though work took him down to, he used to live near Tottenham's training ground just off the M25. But he went to a lot of Liverpool games in recent years, and that's the cop end will. Yeah. I mean, if you've kept goal for one game in that goal, let alone however many hundred you did.
665, Clive.
Well, I mean, in front of the cop, yeah.
Thank you very much to Clive.
Welcome back. Thank you as ever to Clive. An absolute pleasure to speak to him. Moving in then to the LFC specific aspects of this, Ian. Gareth said just before we went over to speak to Clive, he said that Liverpool may well be playing the game a little bit, and I think he might well be right, to be honest with you. All of that said, the reality is that these footballers, Robertson's a very good example, he has a run where he plays a hell of a lot of games, and a lot of those games are very intense. So if he was feeling something, if he was to use Dan's phrase from earlier of in the red, this is an injury crisis, I think, for Liverpool, which is both specific to now, but also they've got to start anticipating it. And they've almost got to look game by game. What do you want to see Klopp do with his team across the next few games, allowing for the lads we know are long-term out and allowing for the more sort of short-term problems?
Well, this is the challenge, isn't it? It's extremely difficult. They've got 11 games until they play Southampton in the first week of January. 8 of them are league games. Now, he's got wriggle room in the Champions League game, so if they can get a result against Atalanta, then they can put that to bed, and you don't really care who he puts out in the last two. If they've qualified, then you can have this debate about finishing first or second.
Well, there's every chance they could qualify first with 12 points. And also, you'd back any side he goes, he picks to go to Michelin and get a draw.
Absolutely. And to be honest, the way draws have transpired over recent years, it's not made a great deal of difference finishing first or second. So just get through, and then you've got that wriggle room then the Champions League. The challenge is obviously the league games, but you know, Liverpool are in a fortunate position where, you know, when Klopp talks about a lack of leadership from Richard Masters and how it's been sold to other clubs, you know, some of these clubs think there's a diddle in there where they're gonna get shafted. But listen, the diddle's on its way. At some point, you're gonna be on the end of this. It's on its way to you. Now, just because one or two clubs have been fortunate at this stage, at some point, you think everyone's going to be on their arse. At some point. Now, Liverpool have got a fantastic squad, so we know they're missing world-class footballers. But if people like Robertson and Henderson are fit, we know Thiago's on his way back. We know Fabinho's on his way back. Guess what? Liverpool are putting out a hell of a team out against Leicester still, even without Virgil, even without Gomez. It's still a side that's probably going to have four or five world-class footballers in it. So Liverpool will probably be okay across the course of a season. But some of these other clubs, they're going to really suffer. I mean, Robbo mentioned Spurs before. Now, I think Mourinho's all about the glory, and I think he's desperate to win any kind of cup. So that would worry me a little bit, because he might be putting players into games where they're not ready. You saw it in the League Cup against Chelsea. He puts players in there on a Tuesday night. They've got a game on a Thursday, thinking, fucking hell, I can't believe that team he's put out. It's unreal. It's absolutely unreal. So I think there's risks there. You know, you mentioned the international football. Robbo, I'd be amazed if Liverpool aren't having conversations. They probably would have wanted Joe Gomez not to go. Dan made a point before. It's hard because players want to play for the national team. So it's difficult, but you've got to be cute. You've got to be clever where you can. You know, you mentioned Giggs. Giggs ends up with 64 caps for Wales. 64 caps. He plays for fucking 30 years. what's fucking going on there? Well, Ferguson was clever. So, you know, Giggs, Neville, both. They've given interviews, haven't they, where they've said the manager will come to them and go, listen, I need you for this game, 3 or 4 weeks' time. You're the man for it. You know, whether you're going to be taking people on, whether you're going to be stopping the opposition, you're the player that's going to win us that game. And they're thinking, fucking hell, it's fucking six games till then. What's going on there? I'm not playing till then. He's like, no, I need you for that game. So you've got to have these conversations where you've got to be clever with your own players and just plot their course, because some will be able to go more than others, and there'll be some who just, they need to have those regular breaks. And the Gomez thing was really unfortunate, wasn't it? Because you, before the injury, and it's not hindsight here, because you know Gomez has had injuries, you're thinking it'd be great to give Gomez a rest, but he just couldn't, because they didn't have the extra men in the squad to be able to allow him not to play. And he's played and played and played, gone away with England and suffered the injury. It's the toughest challenge for any manager this season, but we have got the best in the business.
Well, on that, I wonder whether he's got a big circle around December the 12th onwards, and then two smaller circles around Leicester and particularly around Wolves. And I wonder whether your sort of players in cotton wool argument of Matip, Fabinho, Thiago, I think he's looking at maybe Leicester, I think he's looking at Wolves, and he's saying, I get them on the pitch for them games, guaranteed. Like, I wouldn't surprise me if Brighton away is a fucking mad team. Like, absolutely mad, to the likes of which we haven't seen in a while under Klopp. And I just wonder whether, this team we see against Leicester on Sunday isn't a team that gets maybe seen again until Wolves, and then again until that run from Fulham onwards, because I think that's when...
Or maybe even Tottenham. Maybe even Fulham's a bit of a mad team, and Tottenham, he thinks, right now, that's when I put me absolutely all chips on the table.
Yeah, but sort of Tottenham then here on in is, okay, it's everyone as fit as we can on the pitch, and then you gamble, then you get the Atalanta result and you qualified.
There's just on all of it as to how he thinks about it, how he does it, how he works through it with them. He finds himself, I think, Gareth, there's obviously now a shorter gap between Liverpool and Atalanta, but there's part of me that I think people were... I saw a few people when they moved the game to Sunday night, Klopp will be livid. There was a part of me thinking, I think he might like the extra day. He might just like the extra day and think, you know what, Atalanta is what it is. I've got to cop for something, so I'll bite this bullet, get one more day with them, be able to assess them and go from there. I think that there might be a series of surprise selections, as Dan's saying, but at times it might be surprisingly strong. Where's that come from? Because he's getting information about what they're doing in training and where they are. And the other thing I think we need to remember is we always just sort of talk about the players as the players. They'll all be at different places on their own individual bar charts, so there's not one answer for them.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think it helps us that, you know, both Leicester and Atlanta are at home as well. So, you know, while he has sort of lost the day in a way, you know, at least they're not sort of traveling around and things like that, because we know the toll that takes on them. But what I take heart from as well is the amount of people that have been introduced to the first team environment over the last sort of, whatever, 18 months, 2 years. So, you know, all of a sudden now, if you're saying Nico Williams gets dropped in, well, he's not getting dropped in cold, he's been and done it before. Curtis Jones now is basically a senior player for Liverpool, which sort of goes forgotten sometimes. Then you've got the older heads. Obviously, Milner can literally play anywhere near enough that you want him to. He's your break glass. You know, you've got Tsimikas, which everyone seems to have forgotten about. He'll want a game of footy at some point.
It'd be nice if he turned up.
Do you know what I mean? and then you're on to Jota and everything else. So, you know, like I said before, I totally understand why people are stressing and getting panicked about all this. But equally, I think Ian said it before, you know, look at the players we can get on the pitch. Look at the players we will be able to put out in this run. And it's still all right. It's still all right, you know. And we just have to hope, you know, there is a stick and plaster aspect to it. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, on the dark arts and on the management of stuff, the other stuff I've been wondering about is, like, well, where's Thiago really at? And, you know, did they sort of hang on with him and say, listen, we won't put you out because then you'd have to go and play in an international?
And also, you played all the way through until the last possible game last season. You went as deep as anyone, deeper than any Manchester City player, any Manchester United player. How do we get you into shape so you have a really strong last 25 games? Don't worry about the first 30.
Exactly. So, you know, all of this will be thought about, you know, no theory that anyone ever comes up about as someone at the club not already had. I'm convinced of it these days. I don't think...
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't think we've got...
They're not listening to this going, have you heard the lads in the Anfield? That was interesting. What, lie about the injuries? No.
But, you know, once upon a time, though, you would be like, what's the club doing? And like, you know, like, well, you know, with all these injuries, I was waiting to see someone do it. I almost did it myself, and then I thought, it's such an old joke now, and look, there'll be loads of lads who won't even get it. But, you know, like, all these injuries start to mount up, and I was thinking, when's someone going to mention Phil Bosman?
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, there was a sort of, all these injuries happened at one point, and I remember then everyone was going, well, if it's something to do with the training... Change the training. Yeah. You know, this isn't that, but yeah, it's so scientific these days, and we know even more so at Liverpool, that you've got to trust them to get through all this, and it's going to be mad, but it's going to be kind of good as well.
No, it's going to be kind of good, and it's interesting. Like, for instance, I'll do the two specific ones. What does he do at centre-half, and what does he do at right-back for the next few games, Ian? Almost like the story of the whole piece. Do you think he just drops Nico Williams in? Do you think he'll feel confident? We'll find out more in the press conference, obviously, on Friday, that he can have Fabinho and Matip for Leicester. But we probably all agree he probably can't have Matip more than once a week from the look of it, so he's got to manage that. What are your expectations about specifically right back and centre half?
I think right back, I think, like Dan said, there'll be games maybe where he feels he can give Williams a go, Nico Williams at right back. I don't think Leicester's one of them, if I'm honest. I think he'll look to maybe an old head. It might just be James Milner there, which is not ideal. We know Milner
can't play. Yeah, he can play eight positions, but he can't play them all in one game.
No, but he might have to cop for right back, because if there's enough midfielders back, so if all of a sudden he has got Henderson and he has got Thiago for it, and then I agree with the Thiago thing, because I think if he'd have played in the game before the international break, then he's going away with the international team. That's a pain in the arse. You don't want that. We'll cop for that game. It's about copping for stuff sometimes, isn't it? So we'll take it on the chin, that game that you can't play. But it means you haven't got to go and play two or three for the international team. We get to keep you, we get to work with you, and you get to go again. I think he'll be fit for Leicester. I think Fabinho, in terms of the time scales that were initially outlined, he should be there or thereabouts. He goes and plays centre-half next to Matip. If Matip can do the Leicester game, he plays the Leicester game. And then you've got to do a little bit of rejigging, probably for Atalanta. And listen, Reece Williams is going to get football. He wouldn't have expected it. It's not ideal, because I think...
Can I just stop you on that and come back to Reece on just specific... One of the things that occurred to me when the Gomez injury happened was the idea of Reece Williams' phone. Because all of a sudden, this is the biggest 6 weeks of Reece Williams' life. Same with Nat Phillips. That all of a sudden, you know, imagine what you'd be like going into training, thinking, there's a spot here. I can grab an opportunity. And that, to me, is a really interesting thing that just doesn't happen to the Reece Williams' or the Nat Phillips' of this world very often anymore in football. It's a club the size of Liverpool.
Neil, football, it's about opportunities. And sometimes you'll hear footballers look back on the career and go, you know, the career turned out because I had that break at the very beginning, and that break gave me an opportunity that under normal circumstances, you know, you slide in doors moments, it doesn't happen, you don't get the break, you're not kicking about in the resis for 2 or 3 years and you go somewhere else. He's got an opportunity. Now it's up to him to go and see whether he can prove himself and whether he's at that level. It's always difficult for young centre-half, because we've all seen enough of them in the past where they'll make mistakes, they'll switch off for a second. You know, Rio Ferdinand was one of the best ones, but until Ferguson got a grip of him at 24, he's making consistent mistakes when he turns off. So it's difficult for young centre-halves. You make a mistake, guess what? It probably ends up in a goal. So it's not easy. And he's not going to have a regular player next to him who's of a level where he's playing all the time, because Matip will have that one game a week. He might be playing next to a centre midfielder at some points. It's not great. It's going to be really tough for him, but he has got that... The wraparound support in terms of the senior pros, the club, the manager, that he'll hopefully need and use, and he'll get by on that. But we'll probably come on to it in a little bit. Liverpool, make no mistake, they've got to do some business in January.
I think a lot of this is going to be opposition specific as well. So, you know, you can look at it and say, well, I don't know,
Atalanta, Reece Williams has already played against them. Yeah. So at least he knows them. Now, they know him, that's a double-edged sword, but at least he knows them, and he keeps a clean sheet, so he can feel like, well, I haven't got anything to be scared of there. Yeah. Brighton a little bit different. We saw what they did to Nico Williams last season when we went to their gaff.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, again, so Fabinho's a classic example of this in terms of where do you want to put your Fabinho chips? And use Leicester as an example. Okay, if we get Fabinho in a back four, then we don't have to drop as deep and we can defend a little bit higher again, because they're not going to try and sort of pin you back and get balls in the box per se. Or do you want Fabinho, if he's fit, in that contemporary number six role, breaking up play and looking to counter press? And it's all about that's the tactical side of it that often we don't sort of see. We just see about where are our strengths. Well, they spend all week identifying opposition weaknesses, so they're going to have to do that now with the squad of players they've got. So that's where I think, when we talk about a few mad selections, it wouldn't surprise me to go, you're looking at a team, she's going, what's happened there? Where have they got to that? And it's actually very opposition specific in what they're doing.
There's a chance we get a lot of games like Everton at home last season, where from nowhere you're like, hang on, this. Like, I think people are going to be surprised how much Divock Origi there's about to be in their lives.
Yeah, and Shaqiri as well. That's what I meant before when I said it'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is a bizarre sort of, yes, we'd love to see the first 11 every single week fit, playing, winning matches. But when you have to call on some of these lads who are in and around the squad and then they do something, that's actually boss. You know, that's great. It's really good to see that 5-2 against Everton was fantastic. Who didn't enjoy the fact that you went from going, what the fuck's this team you've put out, lad, to brilliant? Do you know what I mean? And I just think maybe, like, I think there's maybe a critical mass thing there in terms of how many injuries we can tolerate, by the way. I think it's worth saying that as well. So, for instance, if we put some of these younger lads out on the pitch, I've every faith that they'll do all right if they've got, say, Henderson in front of them to talk them through it. You know, I thought we saw with, you know, Nat Phillips got loads of praise, and rightly so, for how he performed against West Ham. But he's doing a lot of stuff simply, and everyone's sort of copping for that fact, basically.
Go and stand next to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you know, going 5 yards away from him and go, I'll have the ball, lad, and I'll play it forward. You don't bother with that. He did play one decent pass forward, I remember, in that game, but by and large, he played it simple, and that was fine. And I think that's what you've got to remember. I mean, I think we can get too focused on individuals, and just I didn't intend to watch it, but I thought it was interesting. There was a thing on the telly last night, it was a repeat thing, but it was about the 1966 England side, and you know, it was quite good, actually. I wouldn't have ordinarily watched it, but I was doing something else and it was on. But they were talking about Nobby Styles, they were talking about Jack Charlton, and they were saying these were players that weren't really rated that much, and sort of, it was a bit of a surprise that they were consistently in the England side, but it was because they were there to do a specific job, to win the ball, to battle for the ball, and then give it to the more creative lads. I mean, I think, you know, Alf Ramsey literally said, I think, to Nobby Styles, you know, just win the ball and give it to Bobby Charlton. That's your job, lad. And so, you know, if you're saying to Phillips, just win the headers, lad. Just win the tackles and get rid. You know, we've played from the back and we've seen all the silky stuff and we've seen Van Dijk's brilliant passes and we've seen Gomez bringing it out, Mata bringing it out and all that. We might have to just cop for the fact that we go a little bit more alehouse at the back, but we've still got all of us lads up front.
Are you expecting, for me, when we talk about specific games there, I think Dan's circled a few of them quite neatly, Leicester, Wolves, Tottenham, 3 home games coming up. If they can get Thiago and Henderson on the pitch, I'm expecting to see Thiago and Henderson on the pitch, Gareth. I think the front, the attacking aspect almost sorts itself. I think whenever Sadio Mane's fit, I expect him to play because of the nature of the athlete he is as much as anything else. They might be a little bit more careful with Salah maybe, but I'm expecting that. But for me, the thing I'm expecting to see is whenever Thiago and Henderson can both be on the pitch, they both will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, you've got to think about what a problem that causes then for the opposition.
Yeah.
That you can get too focused on the fact that, you know, you mentioned Milner before, and, you know, the minute you're thinking of Milner in a back four against Leicester, you're thinking of Vardy fucking knocking it past them and see you later. But, you know, if the ball never gets to Vardy, and if Liverpool dominate possession, which they probably will do against Leicester, but they do something with the possession, you've got Thiago picking out balls that no one else can see bar him, then all of a sudden Leicester have got a problem, haven't they? Not Liverpool.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, you play Milner there, of course, there's a chance that he can get done for pace at times, but he is an experienced pro, and I'd back him over maybe a young kid who's not got the experience. I think Liverpool at times, you know, we so used to see them playing a high line now, but all of a sudden, if you've got a Fabinho and a Matip in there, then they can't play the same way as a Virgil van Dijk and a Joe Gomez. They can't. You've got to take the opposition into account. We know how good Jamie Vardy is on the counter and on the break, and you've got to accept sometimes you may have to drop 5 or 10 yards and just respect what the opposition have got. But you said before, you know, if you've got a Henderson and a Thiago in front of you, then Liverpool are going to dominate the ball at times. And there will be games where you can't just take it away from the opposition in the first half an hour, as Dan said before.
Just very, very quickly, we play Leicester next. Schmeichel was subbed off after a head injury playing for Denmark. Fofana withdrew from the France under-21 squad with a scan on his knee. Soyuncu is out. Daniel Amate is out. Castagna is out. Ricardo Pereira is out, going right the way through. All the way through this season, what's happening to us will be happening to other people. They may well play a back three of James Justin, who me and you watched, who I don't think looks good enough at right back. Johnny Evans and Christian Fuchs. Christian Fuchs, they've spent 3 seasons trying to get rid of. Mark Albrighton and Luke Thomas as wing backs when they come to Anfield.
How
Leicester.
Fuchs now? Is he about 50?
Is it, yeah, honestly, every year I think he's going. The point here, Dan, is that this is what we're coming up against. We I'm not interested in feeling sorry for ourselves. Firstly, as Gareth says, I think it's really interesting, but in terms of what we do. But the other part of this is, yes, they'll have Vardy, they'll have Maddison, they'll have Tielemans, they'll have Pratt. These are really good players, Leicester. But in the same way, well, we think we'll have Mane, we'll have Jota, we'll have Firmino, we think we might well have Henderson and Thiago, we'll have Gini Wijnaldum. And you've just got to look at what Leicester might have to do to go, well, what could Liverpool do?
Yeah, and also we've got a process that everyone backs and trusts. And I think I got referenced earlier, but you know, this management team will give whatever 11 the best information possible to go out on the pitch and get a result. And if you look at Leicester as an example, I'm not entirely sure, you know, that's the case. We've seen it ourselves with someone like Rodgers, who was trying to sort of overly manage certain situations tactically in the past and stuff like that. Whereas I think you've got 25 plus here, whoever will be in that squad, initial squad, who will back the process and back the information given to them. And I think that's where the trust in the likes of Nat Phillips and Curtis Jones, etc., comes in throughout the squad, throughout the year, because I think they back themselves enough. I think they're secure enough in themselves as a management team to say, no, we're giving them the best information on Leicester. We're putting them in the best possible position to go out and win this game. And we back whoever that is then. And I think they've got a lot of that to do. They've got a lot of that firefighting to do. But I back them because we've seen it come to fruition. We've seen what it can yield.
Okay. John Gibbons spoke to Martina Cox about her book, With Hope in Your Heart. Here is that conversation between them. And we will be back to have a little chat about the January transfer window. I know Ian's itching to.
So it is John Gibbons for the Anfield Wrap. I'm delighted to be joined over Zoom by Martina Cox. And Martina is joining us because she's written a book, and it's a book about Sean Cox, which is her husband. And it's a book about their life together, and it's called With Hope in Your Heart. And so we're going to talk about that. And so Martina, first of all, thank you and welcome to the Anfield Wrap.
Thank you, John.
So first of all, I guess, I mean, it's a bit of an obvious question, but why did you decide to write the book about your life with Sean?
Well, I was actually approached by Susan Keogh, who is a journalist, and she ended up being the ghostwriter. She more or less kind of said to me, look, I really think there's a really good story in there that people would want to hear, you know, and kind of just took it from there. And we kind of gelled as, you know, two people together. You have to have a good relationship with somebody if you're going to be talking for hours, which we did. We done it over like WhatsApp video in the middle of lockdown. So it wasn't like we were face to face doing it, which is kind of unusual as well, but it worked really well. So
yeah, it's a great book. I really enjoyed reading it, and I was sent over a copy last week, and I thought I'll just read the sort of the Liverpool-y bits for this, but loved it all, and it split into before and after, and it was really nice reading about your relationship and kind of, as I say, you know, getting to know you both kind of through that. I thought it was really nicely written, and I loved the story about when you first met and you were basically ignored because there was a game of footy on.
Yeah, well, that just goes to show, like, from a very, you know, it was in Sean from a very early age. It wasn't just football, it was golf, it was whatever, you know. He's just a sports fanatic, really, you know.
Yeah. The bit I really want to focus on with you, Martin, if you don't mind, is the after part of the book. And as I say, the before stuff, you know, is beautifully written, but it's there for people, and it's better in your voice, certainly, than mine. But I think the after is, you know, I found very uplifting, and that's what I want people to sort of, you know, to get from that, because obviously it was a horrific thing that happened, but the support you received from the people of Liverpool, from Liverpool Football Club, and we'll come on to from football fans generally, you know, is a really kind of, you know, as I say, an uplifting element to this kind of awful incident. And it's fair to say that support was there from almost from night one, really. And I was really touched by the story of you sort of being in the hospital and being approached by, I think it was Tony Barrett, who came to you and said, basically, whenever you come over, here's a number and this person will organise your accommodation, your flights, and just look after everything for you. And that must have been a really kind of touching thing, not just from a financial point of view, because, you know, money's important, but from a point of view, if that's something I don't have to worry about for this period, then I can just
Tony Barrett came came on the scene literally the day we arrived, which was the first day. It was the Wednesday, it was the day after, with I think one of the chaplains, and he came and met myself, and Peter and Martin were there at the time. And, you know, basically we're there like kind of, I mean, it was very early days. We didn't really know where we were at, but it was touch and go at that stage with Sean. We didn't know what the outcome was going to be, but they basically were there to say, look, you know, we're there, in a very kind of discreet way. Like, you know, they gave us, you know, their cards and said, look, you know, anything you want, just, you know, we're at the end of the phone. And kind of that's the way it was. But, you know, Tony did check in, you know, and he came up a couple of times to visit, you know, just to make sure, to see how things were and how we were and if there was anything that we needed as such.
Yeah, so that support was there from, you know, as I say, from the first night. And you mentioned Peter Moore there, who I know you've spoken to, you know, on a number of occasions now and had that sort of long relationship with. And you talk in the book about how there was maybe not necessarily an expectation from you, but a fear that, well, this will go away and we'll kind of get forgotten about it. And as such, you know, after the first sort of few weeks, and he made assurances to you that wouldn't happen. And it's fair to say they've been kept.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, right from the word go, you know, we obviously met Peter Moore the first time in their offices, and, you know, we had a good chat. And, you know, I suppose at that point it was like, what can the club do for Sean? Obviously they didn't, I mean, what happened didn't happen on their grounds as such, it happened outside. But, you know, yeah. Sean was a long-standing Liverpool fan. So, you know, they reassured us that they were, you know, going to help in whatever way they could. And that's when they came up with, you know, lots of different ideas. And obviously out of that came the football match in the Aviva, the Liverpool Legends match, which was hugely successful. And, you know, they'd done the book of collection in Liverpool. So, you know, it was fantastic.
Obviously, very, very soon after the home leg against Roma, we travelled over there, and, you know, you forget sort of how quickly that was after that game, really, and you know, how much was done from Liverpool fans to show support from Sean. The banner that was made by Peter Carney, who was in with us this week, I know how much work Peter puts into these, but I didn't realise until I read your book that he'd been up all night, I think, around his birthday and everything, making sure that it was perfect. That must have been an amazing comfort to you.
Yeah, I remember actually that night, because we were obviously still in Liverpool and we were watching it. We were actually having something to eat in a restaurant / kind of pub. And the lads, of course, I think Martin was there and I can't even remember who was there, but, you know, we were looking at the match, and then the flag came up and we were just like, I mean, quite emotional seeing what they had done for Sean. Like, it was just like, you know, Sean is part of the club, and they'd done this for him. Like, it was lovely. It's a lovely touch.
Yeah, and the fact that it's the players as well who were on the pitch with it. So, you know, in the stands, you know, it would have looked fantastic because the flag is wonderfully put together. But the fact that it was it's an iconic image now for any of us, really. And
it is. I mean, it's been everywhere. It's been a lot of different places. It's still in the cop at the minute. So, it's amazing, really. And it's just, it is kind of iconic, really.
Yeah. Obviously, a lot of people connected with the football club wanted to get in touch with you and show you support. There's a really funny story around Kenny Dalglish, which I hope you don't mind telling on here. It's in the book, but if you don't mind, it's I think you've experienced firsthand what it is like to be around Kenny Dalglish, and that is that, you know, everyone else pales into insignificance.
Yeah, I mean, we decided that, you know, obviously Tony Barrett actually said that he wanted to come in and meet myself and Jack, and Sean's cousin Richard was there at the time because there was lots of people coming and going. So Tony arranged the visit. He knew, obviously, at that stage, Sean was still, you know, in a coma. So he just said he wanted to meet the family just to kind of, you know, offer his support as such. So the arrangement was that we'd meet not in the hospital, just at the back of the hospital where we were staying. So there was a couple of, there's like a little coffee shop there. So we were sitting waiting, and then, you know, Kenny and Tony Barrett arrived, and I swear to God, the girl in the coffee shop, she nearly fell over her feet running out when she seen Kenny arrive, and you know, she's like, what do you have to drink, Kenny? And he was like, I'll have a cappuccino. She never asked the rest of us. We were just sitting there waiting, and you know, she was just so busy, so, you know, entranced by him and what he wanted. It was funny. Like, really, we all just laughed, and you could see, you know, people were going by and they were all recognizing him, and they were getting, you know, pieces of paper out of their bags and pens. And of course, Kenny, as he does, obliged absolutely everyone that was there, you know.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, and he spent a lot of time with us, you know, he gave us a lot of his time, and, you know, he was just really there, just kind of, you know, just giving us support and, you know, saying how awful, you know, what had happened, you know, that, you know, they were appalled by what had happened to Sean. And just, you know, it was like, whatever we can do. And, you know, he actually presented me with a lovely jersey, a signed jersey for Sean as well, which we have framed. And really nice.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And obviously the big man as well, Jürgen Klopp, has been, you know, speaking to you for quite a long time now, you know, in those early sort of days after, and right up to writing the foreword for the book, yeah. Which isn't bad. And I know jumping on a Zoom call with you a couple of weeks ago as well.
Yeah. He zoomed into Dunboyne in County Meath, which was lovely. It was really nice. And Sean was obviously there as well. And Jack and Sean's sister, Sinead. And we had a really good chat. And, you know, he's just like, you know, he's not just a manager, like he's a dad, he's a family man. So he gets all those things, you know, but like, as he said as well, like it's football is really important, but family equally is hugely important as well.
One of the things that comes across in the book as well is that how much, you know, the football supporters wanted to support you and wanted to support Sean, and not just Liverpool fans. And I think, you know, it's a really nice part of the book where you talk about a Manchester United fan writing to you and saying that, you know, he might support a very different team, but actually this year he'd be quite happy for Liverpool to win the league, for Sean. And no, it was the Champions League, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we got that's lots an incredible of that. Thing. Yeah, and you know, there was a lot of those. It was Everton, lots of Everton fans were like, you know, it just the colour doesn't matter. You know, we're all supporters, and you know what happened to Sean, like, just kind of hit a raw nerve with a lot, you know, many people. You know, he was just an ordinary guy going to watch his beloved team, and then this happened. So I think so many people, you know, supporters, you know, whether you were a Man United fan or Everton or whatever, they just so resonated with what actually happened.
So in the book, you sort of admit that, you know, you don't know a huge amount about football, you know, you're not claiming to be the sort of, you know, the biggest Liverpool fan. You know, that was Sean's thing. Sean went over and travelled over with his friends and family for the sort of the game, and obviously still is a sort of huge Liverpool fan, even though he's not been able to, you know, do the travelling as much. And has your relationship with the club and the city sort of now changed? It must have, because, you know,
I admit I didn't know one person's name on that team beforehand, and now I know them all. And, you know, it's just because of the situation with Sean. So I'm kind of, you know, his eyes and ears, I suppose. You know, like, yeah, obviously when there's a match, we watch it. I just have an interest now because they've shown a vested interest in Sean. So, you know, I have an interest in what's going on now. Because of what happened, you know, and because they've been so good to us, it's just, I suppose it's just a natural thing. Now, I admit I don't watch every match, but I do kind of listen to, I kind of know what's going on, you know, for sure. Something that I never dreamt I'd have to do, but, you know, it's like, you know, you just do it for Sean because it, you know, it's makes him happy, you know?
Yeah. So, what would you do? I guess this is a way to speak to a lot of Liverpool fans now, and there's a lot of people, you know, thankfully for us, kind of listen to sort of what we do. And, you know, what would you say to the listeners who have sort of supported you, you know, financially, which has obviously been a massive help because Sean needs round the clock care, but also, you know, those letters that you sort of received, you know, what would you say to those Liverpool fans?
Well, just like a massive big thank you to everybody who supported Sean, who sent cards, just, you know, whatever they'd done, everything was so meaningful. You know, there was, you know, even when we stayed in Liverpool, you know, there was cards coming into the Walton Centre, you know, saying, you know, we're Liverpool supporters, we're Irish. There's huge connection with Liverpool and Ireland as well.
Yeah.
They are, you know, they're originally from Mayo or wherever in Ireland. We've got a spare bedroom. If anyone, any of your family are coming over, you know, feel free to contact us if there's anything you want, you know, if you need a lift to the shops, anything. People were just outpouring, you know, they just wanted to help. And so really, like, I just want to say a big thank you to everybody. People are just, you know, when the chips are down, people really, really kind of all come together, which is fantastic.
Yeah, one of the positive things about humanity,
absolutely,
definitely.
Yeah.
So finally, just before we let you go, how is Sean? How's he doing?
Yeah, he's good. He's, you know, he's doing a lot better since he came home. You know, I mean, there is, as they say, there is no place like home. You know, it's like it's in his own environment. You know, it's his own house. You know, we've the dogs trailing around the house. You know, just all normal. Like, you know, we're trying to make things as normal as possible. Yes, he's lots of difficulties. You know, he's still in a wheelchair and will be. But, you know, he's in a much better place. You know, he's working hard. He's, you know, he's got physio 4 days a week. He's got speech and language. He's got music therapy. So, like, he's making progress. Like, there's nothing faster, you know, about the recovery of a brain injury. It's a slow process. But, you know, he's doing good. And, you know, they're happy with him. And, you know, I suppose the most important thing is that he's happy in himself. Which Great. Is all that I want, really, you know?
Yeah. No, that's lovely to hear. That's wonderful to hear. So the book, anyway, is called With Hope in Your Heart, The Sean Cox Story by Martina Cox. And obviously, as you mentioned, written that with Susan Keogh as well. It is out now. I would encourage people to buy it. It's a lovely story. And, you know, it's, as Jürgen Klopp himself said, they're full of love. And if Jürgen says that, then of course it is true. So, but Martina, thank you so much for joining us over Zoom. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you very much to Martina and to John. Do check the book out. Sounds really, really impressive. And in general, thank you very much to Martina for taking the time to do the interview there. Onwards then, Ian, to January. It was interesting, the club seemingly putting out the words that they may not be that interested in centre-halves come January. This is Liverpool surely just doing a little bit of media management. You would expect them to be interested in January, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd hope so. I think, you know, there's maybe a managing expectations piece there from Liverpool. You know, you sometimes see clubs put the narrative out that they don't want to sign anyone because they don't want to be seen to be in the market for someone. But listen, there's no secrets here. I mean, everyone knows Liverpool leads into the halves. They've watched the two best ones go down with injuries, long-term ones. So it'll come as no surprise that Liverpool are sniffing around for centre-halves in January. And I think they've got to do something, Neil. You know, manage expectations, yes, I get it. But they've got to come out of that window with footballers.
Before the break there, before we spoke to Martina there, I listed to you Leicester's centre-half options, which consists of a 50-year-old left-back, right-back who hasn't looked up to it so far, and Johnny Evans. My point here is, what club that takes itself seriously, that has centre-halves good enough to play for Liverpool, is selling one of them, not just to Liverpool, but full stop, in January of this season, when we're all sat around saying, I tell you what, there's a lot of injuries, isn't there?
No one said it's easy, you know what I mean? I'm not sitting here saying it's easy, but...
Is this why Michael Edwards gets paid the big bucks and you don't?
Absolutely. So the work will be going on in the background, I'm absolutely sure of that, but I think it's about trying to exploit certain situations. You might not get two, you might want two, you might not get two, you might just get one, and maybe you can do something on a loan. Because as you said, there's going to be clubs who are going to be sniffing around for similar players. You know, the Alaba one's been mentioned as a possible. You know, maybe there's legs in that. Maybe there's mileage.
But then
in
Kimmich
it.
Gets injured.
Yeah.
So if I'm running by Munich, I'm saying we don't want to let him go if Kimmich has got injured.
But you know, some of these players will become a problem for their own clubs and can force a move.
That's really
and
fair.
You can have a conversation about whether you want players like that, but listen, that's football. It happens everywhere. And I think someone like that, whilst he's not the physical specimen that Virgil van Dijk is, he's not even the physical specimen that Joe Gomez is. He's about 5'11", he's a former left back, plays centre half, but he's extremely progressive in his passing. His passing metrics are off the scale. They're brilliant. He offers a lot, multiple positions. He can take set pieces. I remember reading an article where he used to model himself on Janino, the ex-Leon player. A wonderful footballer. So that's the kind of player. I think if you can do something there, like I said, not easy, but if you can do something there, that adds something to Liverpool. And maybe they try and go and get someone on loan. But if you're going to be missing Van Dijk, and we don't know how long he's out for, and that's the thing, you know, it could be a lot longer than some of us hope or want. And Joe Gomez, from all the signs you're hearing, if he gets back, it's probably going to be May. Liverpool, they probably felt they had to compromise somewhere this transfer window just to manage budgets and stuff, and they compromised at centre-half. Some people won't have liked that, but maybe they always felt they were going to compromise, and that's where they chose to. They only had Matip, and he can't play more than once a week. So there's not a scenario for me where Liverpool can just go, we'll try and make do and put midfielders in there. That's fine. But those are the midfielders that you're banking on playing in midfield. They've got to stay fit. Otherwise, you've not got the options. So I don't want to see a scenario where we try and go with Matip once a week, because it just keeps getting more intense. And fatigue will kick in, wear and tear will kick in the more you get into the season. Reece Williams, he might be the best prospect ever, but he's still a kid. You can't expect him to keep to go. And then he won't be used to that level of football for a start, and he won't be used to the intensity. So the chances are he could break down because it's just too intense. And Nat Phillips, Robbo mentioned it before, West Ham plays with strength. Don't want to take anything from the kid. He had a good game that night. I don't particularly want to see him play regularly, and I think people will figure him out quite quickly. You get amongst him, you get it on the floor. I don't think he's great with his passing. I think they'll expose him quite quickly. Liverpool have to do something at centre-half for me.
Yeah, I think like you say, Neil, it's just part of the game. And what I would always say about this is that as much as, you know, well, we're part of the football media ourselves as well these days, but, you know, Liverpool don't have to tell anyone anything. This isn't Crown Court, it's football. So, you know, they don't have to come out and say, we want a centre-half in January, we expect to buy a centre-half in January. Because, you know, that seems counterintuitive to do that and wave your arms everywhere saying, I mean, yeah, everyone knows, like you say, Ian, but equally, you know, you just don't come out and say it, do you? You know, you just sort of at least make out, at least do the dance that you think you can make do. Because when it comes to negotiations, you've still got it in your locker then to say, oh, we'll leave it then, if you're trying to take advantage of us too much with the fee. I think where you've got to back Liverpool is that since Jurgen Klopp came in, by and large, you know, 90% of transfers have been right. And, you know, they've done that by taking the time, by being careful, by having targets, by not being knee-jerk. And all I think is that, you know, I've consistently heard that they're interested in buying a centre-half in the summer. So can they move that forward? And will they have to pay a premium for it? Probably. And will that be worth it? Well, probably. Because, you know, everything we said in the show earlier is that I think we're all back in Liverpool to still be in the mix, regardless of all these injuries. So if we're in the mix, we've got 11 games to tackle before we can go and buy someone. Stay in the mix, come January, go and buy them then. And like I say, you might have to pay a premium, and that might go a little bit against what Liverpool traditionally do. But we want to win stuff this season. We don't want to be writing it off.
My one mild concern, Gareth, when you talk about, for instance, the successes of Liverpool in the transfer market, is it is all from long-term planning.
Yeah.
And that's what they do ever so well. And what they haven't done, where I wonder, whilst I'm very sceptical around the Liverpool won't buy a centre-half in January line, the one thing that makes me wonder if there might be a bit of truth in it is that they love long-term planning. So if they can't, we've seen in the past, if he can't get the one he wants, or the ones he wants, he might have a longer list than he did when it was just Virgil van Dijk. But if he can't get the ones he wants, I think there is a possibility that he will be prepared. Yeah, almost where I end up here, and I don't mean this disrespectful to the footballer or the person in any way, I don't see a Stephen Colker.
Yeah,
I think that if they've got to put money on the table, I think they will only put money on the table for a footballer who they feel, if they're going to buy someone permanently, they'll only buy someone who they feel as though is still playing for Liverpool in 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I think if you were going to, if there was a Clavin equivalent kicking round, that you would have seen him already. I think they would have got him.
That's what I think. I think it would have been done in the summer. Yeah. I think they feel like they've moved beyond Clavins.
Yeah. So now I think it's someone they were planning on long term getting in the summer. Can you bring that forward? And there's various names that we've seen as consistently linked to.
Upamecano, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So will it be one of them? Will it be the lad at Brighton? You know,
Kabak at Schalke.
Yeah, all of those names you're consistently seeing for a reason. So what can Liverpool do with any of those clubs? How desperate are those players to come to Liverpool and be part of what Klopp's doing? All of those things, again, we don't know. All of those things are behind closed doors and curtains and cloaks and all the rest of it. But you've got to back them. I think once upon a time, there were so many discussions around Liverpool where you said, I don't know how good they are at doing the stuff you don't see. Now I think you've got to say they're good at doing the stuff you don't see.
Just to sort of ever so slightly talk against myself, Dan, there is a little part of me that wonders whether or not what we do have on the horizon is Euro 2021 now. It'll still be called Euro 2020 because that's what the branding says. But no one wants to go back to the graphic designers, cost a fortune. They were a nightmare to work with the first time. You've got Euro 2021 on the horizon. And what I do wonder is if Liverpool could find a sneaky loan of a lad they've always quite liked. The example I used on a previous show recently was Jonathan Tarr, not getting many games currently at Leverkusen, would like to view himself as a viable prospect, as a footballer, I'm sure. I do wonder if Liverpool, if they have to get creative, that might be part of what helps them get creative, is bring someone in who currently isn't getting games, who would quite like to play international football next summer.
Yeah, and I think, sort of to echo what everyone else has said, in a way, I think it needs to get even beyond this in terms of injury crisis or crises. I think it needs to go sort of one step further where, you know Matip's out for the next 6 months and then, you know, Nat Phillips and Fabinho go down, and then it's okay. This is desperate now. Like, literally.
Fucking hell, Dan.
Literally, like, yeah.
Gotta paint a bleak story, Mr. Morgan.
Well, tell you, I hope no one just walks past the, like, speaker or whatever, and then it's that bit.
What? No, I genuinely think that's sort of the nature of which they will back themselves and sort of hold the breath with it. And I think the long term plan is fundamental to that. I think the summer plan is fundamental to it because I think the answer they wanted the question to was, how do we, in a way, clone Joe Gomez or find the next Gomez around that age, 22, 23? So I think Alaba's out the question. I don't think they're not in the market for an option at centre-half, but I think the likes of Alaba, 28, mega money, is completely out the equation for them. I think it's a no-go. And I think that, for me, look, it also, you'd have to ask the question of what you want in a centre-back right now. Do you want a lad who can do his one-on-ones and be progressive with the ball? Okay, we back Fabinho, stays fit, and we play him there. Do you want a lad who just adds the thing away? We've got Nat Phillips there. All he does is fucking nut the thing. So, you know, what are we asking in the centre-half that we haven't already got?
I think my thoughts on this, I think Liverpool will do something. Neil, you mentioned before, other teams will be thinking similar things. They'll have injuries. Liverpool's situation is very, very specific because it's two centre-halves that are out for months and months. I think if you're managing a season where...
And you've got someone out for 3 weeks.
Yeah, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, you'll listen, we've just got to take this on the chin, it happens, we'll manage it internally because we can do that for that amount of time. This is long-term stuff where, you know, there's no return dates on either player, really. You're all about point. I think in normal circumstances, maybe you don't look at that as an option. But I think one thing Liverpool are going to miss is that ball out from the back. And Virgil van Dijk had that passing range where he's releasing a Mohamed Salah. And all of a sudden, that's been taken away. Now, maybe you can drop one or two players in to do a little bit of that at times, but no one's got the passing range of him. And I think that hurts us massively when teams press us and we haven't got the out, which is why I could see a scenario where they look at someone like Alaba. He doesn't match the physical profile of what you'd normally look at, but he does offer something on the deck in terms of that passing range that I think Liverpool would like to see. It might not be him, but it has to be someone.
Okay, thank you very much this week. Martina Cox, Clive Tilsley, John Gibbons, and in front of me, the fabulous Dan Morgan, Gareth Roberts, and Ian Ryan. It has been a pleasure with the Anfield Wrap this week. Everything you need for a massive, intense period of the season coming for Liverpool Football Club. Game after game after game will be there for you. Post-match shows, previews, everything that you could possibly want. It's theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe for all of that. Video, audio, and the writing as well. It is the absolute business, and right now is a time where Liverpool can grit their teeth and get stuck into a fantastic season. As Gareth said before, if nothing else, it'll be interesting. As Ian said before, if nothing else, it will be intense. Let me tell you, it'll be the absolute business. Liverpool are not going to let this league title go lightly. It will take more than a couple of injuries to stop them. Sports Social Podcast Network.